I think the only sane position to take for an Australian government is to assume that this will be a passing phase in American politics. It may not be, but I think it's important to sustain the fundamentals of the alliance with the United States, deal with as many sane people in the administration as possible, minimize your engagement with President Trump as possible, personally, and sit and wait in terms of what happens in 3 years' time.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. Kevin Rudd has just produced an autobiography. Well, half of one, actually. His book, Not for the Faint-Hearted, is nearly 700 pages. But it only takes us to the 2007 elections. The next instalment will come later. The former Prime Minister now spends much of his time in the United States, where he's president of the Asia Society Policy Institute in New York. But he also is often in Australia, especially in his home city of Brisbane, and he keeps up with the Australian scene. He joins us today during his book tour. Kevin Rudd, do you miss the political life, or have you got beyond that now?
I'm way beyond that. Since I have started working in the United States, firstly at Harvard and now in New York as president of the Asia Society Policy Institute, frankly, I've just broadened out into a whole new range of public policy domains. And the people I work with most, the government in the United States, government in Beijing, on common policy challenges in regional security, regional economics, as well as the big and enduring challenge of climate change. So, no, I'm happy as a pig in mud.
Now, just looking back on your political life and your book, who were the people who had the greatest influence on you?
I think certainly in the formative years it would have been a combination of Wayne Goss, the then leader of the State Parliamentary Labor Party and then Premier of Queensland, who frankly pulled off the impossible by defeating the National Party against a massive gerrymander. And Tom Burns, his deputy, who was an old-style Labor guy, became Deputy Premier of Queensland. These guys had a huge influence on me. And I think after I came to Canberra, I always was able to sustain a good and close relationship with Father Frank Brennan. And Frank was always the one belting me around the head on the sort of things I should be focusing on in public life.
Now, you settle a few old scores in the book.
Not too many.
No, not too many, but you certainly go for one. You're particularly critical of Wayne Swan, emphasising how reluctant you were to have him in the Treasury job. But would things have been different in terms of policy, leaving aside his role in the coup against you, but in terms of policy, if you'd bitten the bullet and installed Lindsay Tanner instead?
Well, to put your question to its context first, if you are looking at a shadow cabinet of some 20 individuals, there are only two of them, really, that I take exception to in this volume. One is Mr. Swan and the other is Senator Conroy, for different but for related reasons. I don't think Conroy, for example, ever graduated from Young Labor politics. He was still fighting student elections from the 1980s. And that was the level of maturity he brought to the politics of our caucus and then of our government. On the question of Mr. Swan and whether I should have appointed Lindsay Tanner instead of him, the book is very clear about the reasons why I made that decision, and I accept responsibility for it. Had I actually put Lindsay in charge, there are two things that would have changed. One, Lindsay would have shared genuinely the intellectual burden with myself and the senior Treasury team on how to deal with the crisis. Wayne was simply often not there, and certainly not an active and constructive contributor to what was a very complex policy debate. Lindsay's a first-class mind. I think the other thing, which I wouldn't just sweep away as a question of parenthesis, Michelle, is that if Swan had not occupied the high office of Treasurer, which I gave him, then his authority would have been less come the time when he and others organised the coup.
Now, looking to Labor today, in your time, you were one of the you were a Labor leader who really had a distance from the unions. Do you think today that Labor is too much in the grip of the unions?
I make a constant distinction in my book, Michelle, from unions and factions. For the unions, I've always been deeply pro-union. It comes from my view of the lot of the poor and the poorer working people of this country and around the world. But also, secondly, if you spend time with school cleaners and the rest, you know that unless their unions are out there fighting for them, for example, through the Miscellaneous Workers Union, then their lot would be much poorer. What I do take exception to, however, are those who politically manipulate union-based factions within the Parliamentary Labour Party as personal power vehicles for themselves and their personal advancement and the people that they like and the people that they hate. And in my case, because I turn my back so fundamentally on the faction-based system, not just in my language, but in my actions, I didn't attend faction meetings. Furthermore, I selected my own front bench rather than give it to a bunch of factional thugs to select for me, and insisted instead that we had a merit-based system. These were deep assaults on factional power, and I think was one of the deep contributing causes to the coup of June of 2010.
Now, you used to identify yourself as Kevin from Queensland. Maybe you still do. And you, as you mentioned, cut your...
Nothing wrong with that, Michelle.
Well, it
worked. You should get there more often.
You
need to get out more, Michelle.
You cut your political teeth with the GOSS opposition and then government. What do you make of the strength in Queensland of Pauline Hanson's One Nation as we look to the state election where it's expected to do pretty well?
It's formidable. And furthermore, I have no criticism to make of those who are supporting it, because they're often doing so out of desperation. And they're doing so out of desperation because of their experience that the mainstream political project delivered by governments of the centre-left and the centre-right are not delivering results which keep them, let's call it, on the bus with opportunities and safety nets which can care for people effectively. I think if you look at the underpinning nature of the Queensland economy, which has been, together with West Australia, always the one most subject to volatility because of the changing nature of commodity prices. When those prices are down, frankly, you're in a very difficult environment across regional Queensland, central Queensland, north Queensland, and in part the West as well. So you put together the nature of the, let's call it the regional economy, plus the inability of mainstream government to deal with their underlying social and economic needs. It's a potent combination of factors which puts people in the direction of supporting populist right-wing causes such as those run by Pauline Hanson. I have nothing but contempt for Hanson because she's all criticism, all critique, with no solutions.
Now, in your present life, you obviously are observing American politics very closely. What do you think the implications will be in the next few years of the Trump presidency, and how should Australia handle Trump, or the Australian government, I should say?
You know something, Michelle, that's a really hard question. Firstly, the nature of the Trump presidency is an evolving feast, and a feast of strategic uncertainty for everybody. Allies included, not just European allies, but Asian allies as well, including Australia. So it doesn't matter which capital you go to, whether you're in London, whether you're in Berlin, or whether you're in Paris, or for that matter in Brussels, the headquarters of NATO. Now, the refrain there is not dissimilar to what you find in Tokyo and in Seoul and in Canberra, which is how the hell do we deal with the volatility of American positions given the unique qualities of this president? So I think the only sane position to take for an Australian government is to assume that this will be a passing phase in American politics. It may not be, but I think it's important to sustain the fundamentals of the alliance with the United States, deal with as many sane people in the administration as possible, minimize your engagement with President Trump as possible, personally, and sit and wait in terms of what happens in 3 years' time. I think the deep problem we all face, however, is that the game moves on over those 3 years, and China's net strategic position will be much stronger in 3 years' time than it is now. Take, for example, Trump's appallingly irresponsible decision not to attend the East Asian Summit in Manila, which is upcoming, instead conceding the ground totally to China, which will be there represented by Xi Jinping, now all-powerful within the Chinese Communist Party.
You're an expert on China, obviously a lifelong expert, and as Prime Minister, you always seem to have a certain wariness of China. You could be quite critical of them. How concerned should Australia be with what appears to be the growing Chinese influence and interference here, for example, in our universities?
Look, I've always believed with the China and US relationship, in both those countries, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. It just requires a little bit of intellectual dexterity and, frankly, considered policy to frame a balanced relationship between these two great powers. What I've always said to our Chinese friends in private and to some extent in public is we've long been an ally of the United States. The reason for that is the US saved us in World War II and framed, therefore, the post-war security architecture. And if you're a country of 25 million people across the landmass and coastal length of a country like Australia, it makes sense to have an ally in a country like the United States. When you put it in those terms, frankly, the Chinese could have quietly nod. And so I think that's one principle. The second is, because this country and its institutions is essentially Western in nature, and the good parts of the West being our Judeo-Christian ethic, the Enlightenment, rationalism, empiricism, let's call it political emancipation, universal suffrage, universal human rights, is a good tradition. It took us 500 years to get there from the time of the Reformation on, but it's a good tradition, shouldn't be junked. And so in engaging our Chinese friends, they would think less of us if we somehow tried to, in some crazy, embarrassed way, to walk away from who we are. Therefore, that is going to generate differences with the Chinese, which we should simply articulate clearly, firmly, politely, without turning that into World War III. And on the economy, it speaks for itself in terms of the depth of the future engagement that we need.
Now, what about the influence here, though? Are you concerned about that?
You know, I'm conscious of the fact that I've been offshore now for about 3 years, and I haven't followed the debate within each of the universities. But let me tell you a little story in a minute or so about Oxford, where I'm currently doing some research on Xi Jinping's worldview. And I was talking to a Chinese student who told me about the official Chinese student organizations there, which are put together by the Chinese Embassy in London. They have a regular weekly gathering. Then the unofficial Chinese student organizations also gather each week. And the official gathering, my friend Tommy, had four people turn up, and everyone else had a huge party. So I think we need to have a little bit of perspective in terms of how Chinese students themselves maturely handle these things. But what I would say is that our academic institutions are Western academic institutions which hold absolutely to the principle of freedom of expression and freedom of thought and freedom of academic inquiry. And there should be no compromise whatsoever to those traditions in any university, whatever the external influence might be.
Kevin Rudd, you're running for a plane, but as we say goodbye, can I ask you, when do we get the next 700 pages?
Well, you're right, Michelle. I do have to zip. I got a zip. And I think you'll probably have it next year, but I'm not holding myself hard and fast to that. I've written a fair bit. I've just got up to the bit, Michelle, where I get killed. And so that is, metaphorically, the coup. So I've decided to put that on hold for a week or two till I resume courage.
Thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thanks, Michelle.
And that's all for today's podcast. Thank you to my producer, Eliza Burlage. We'll be back with another interview soon, but goodbye for now.